This has a lot of repetition in it. Be attentive. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country of Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavatthu for alms. One of the things that seems to be happening here is people seem to consider alms, going out on alms, as begging. Monks don't beg. We go out and we accept food that's given to us, but we don't ask for it. I have done a lot of gathering of alms food for myself when I was in Asia. I don't do it so much here because we live 5 miles from the closest road into town, and that's 7 miles away. That's a long walk. And our closest neighbor is a mile away. And I can't keep going to them and gathering food. So we do have a cook at the center, and she takes care of that sort of thing. I do like going on alms round. When I was collecting food, probably because I was an American and I was very tall, and at the time I was redheaded, I always got enough food to feed 5 people. I'd have to have somebody to come along and carry food for me because it was so much food. But I also gave what I didn't use, I gave it away. So it's not begging, ever. It's collecting. And when the Buddha told us to go out and collect food, he recommended that we start radiating loving kindness to all the beings in the village. And that was one of the reasons that I got so much food, because that's what I practiced. I had some American monks come and visit me at this one place. And one of the monks was senior to me, and we always go by seniority in the Sangha. And we walked about 4 miles and gotten one little dab of rice. So we started turning around. He said, "I want you to walk in front." And as I was walking in front, people came out of the woodwork and started putting food in the bowls. And we had a huge quantity of alms. And the place that I was staying at, they had a place for people that had physical disabilities, and they always had trouble getting food. So whatever I didn't eat, I would take it to them. And I went out on the king's birthday in Thailand, and I just walked out of the gate of the monastery. I went about 20 feet and my bowl was full. And I turned around and started going back. And they said, "Please don't do that. We want to give food to you." So I said, "Well, I can't hold anymore." So they ran and got a plastic bag so I could take the food and put it in the bag, and stood there. And there was a line of, oh, it must have been 40 people anyway that were putting food in my bowl, and I would dump it in the plastic bag, and the plastic bag got filled. So one of the Thai men went and got his pickup truck. And when I finally said, I have to stop accepting food because it's 11 o'clock, I have to go eat. And when I turned around and looked at the truck, it was full. Now, another thing that happened at the monastery I was at, they had an orphanage for about 50 people, 50 kids. So when I took whatever I wanted for food for that day, I had them drive over to the orphanage, and they gave the food to the kids so that they had food for about a week. And I still had some food left over that I couldn't eat, so I took that up to the disabled people. So I got to feed a lot of people that day, and it was good fun. But I don't ask for food ever. And, let's see. When he'd wandered for alms in Kapilavatthu and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he went to the great wood for the day's abiding. Entering the great wood, he sat down at the root of a bulva sapling for the day's abiding. Dandapani, the Sakyan, walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood, and when he'd entered the great wood, he went to the bulva sapling where the Blessed One was and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick. What he did was very disrespectful. I don't care about this kind of thing, but in Asia, the teacher's head is always higher than everybody else's, out of respect. His standing with his head higher than the Buddha and then asking him a question was a show of disrespect. He didn't really like what the Buddha had to say in the first place. Anyway, and he asked the Blessed One, what does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim? Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its Brahmas, and its Maras, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people. I teach in such a way that perceptions no more underlie the Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. When this was said, Dandapani the Sakyan shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead puckered in three lines. Then he departed, leaning on his stick. So that shows you how much respect he had for the Buddha that way too. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to Nigrodha's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him and told the monks what had taken place. Then a certain monk asked the Blessed One, but venerable sir, how does the Blessed One assert and proclaim his teaching in such a way that he does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas? In this generation, with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people. And venerable sir, how is it that perception no more underlies the Blessed One, that Brahman, who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being? Monk, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to delusion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. What is evil, unwholesome states? Close. No. Close. It's a C word. What is craving? It's the I like it, I don't like it mind. How do you recognize craving? Tension and tightness in your mind and in your body. How do you let go of craving? So that's what they call it, evil, unwholesome states, because you're identifying with your thoughts and your feelings and you're taking them personally. And when you do that, you get caught up in all kinds of stories, opinions, ideas, concepts, and suffering. So craving is the cause of suffering. I went all through Asia for 12 years going to big, very famous monks, and I would ask them, what is craving? And they would always say something like desire, it's wanting something. I said, how are you supposed to recognize craving when it arises? Well, that's when you desire something, when you want something. Well, how are you supposed to let it go if you don't know what it looks like when it arises? Let go of craving. Okay, that sounds great, but it doesn't tell you anything. Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. It's the very beginning of the false belief in a personal self. And the way you let it go is by practicing the six R's. And that's not what's being taught by most people these days. They just skim over the noble truths as if the noble truths are just some general kind of thing that everybody's states when they're talking about dependent origination, or when they're talking about the Dhamma. But they don't understand how deep the Four Noble Truths truly are. And I'll show you that tomorrow night. That is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Now, what happened most of the time when somebody would ask the Buddha a question, he would give a short version of it. And if nobody asked him to talk more about it, he would get up and leave. Everybody understood. They didn't ask any questions. Hint, hint, hint. Okay. Then, soon after the Blessed One had gone, the monks considered, "Now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling. After giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning." Now, who will expound this in detail? Then they considered, "The Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He's capable of expounding the detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this." Then the monks went to the Venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, "How are you doing? Are you getting enough food?" Those kind of things they would politely ask. They sat down at one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it to us." Now, Mahakachana cuffs him up a little bit verbally. The Venerable Mahakachana replied, "Friends, it is though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, after he passed over the root and the trunk. So it is with you, Venerable Sirs, that you think I should be asked about the meaning of this after you pass the Blessed One by, when you were face to face with the teacher. For knowing, the Blessed One knows. Seeing, he sees. He is vision. He is knowledge. He is the Dhamma. He is the Holy One. He is the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered it. Surely, friend Kachana, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees. He is vision. He is knowledge. He is the Dhamma. He is the Holy One, the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time that we should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told us, we should have remembered it. Yet the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. The Venerable Mahakachana is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of this summary given in brief by the Blessed One, without expounding the detailed meaning. let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend. The monks replied, the Venerable Mahakachana said this, friend, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, monks, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if there's nothing there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust. The underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency to delusion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is eye contact. With eye contact as condition, there is eye feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. Analyze. Western disease. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So in order to see, you have a good working eye. It hits color and form. Eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three things is called eye contact. With eye contact as condition, there is eye feeling. With eye feeling as condition, there is perception. What is perception? Perception is the part of your mind that names things. You look at this, you say, this is a book. Perception is a part of the mind that put that title on it. Okay? We think in concepts. That's the only way we think. This is a chair. Where is the chair? Is it the legs? Is it the arms? Is it the seat? Is it the back? Where is a chair? A chair is made up of a lot of little things put together to make up a concept that we call chair. That's the way we think. That's why translation is so difficult. When you come in for an interview and you have to tell me something, I have to be able to translate that into something I can see that you're trying to say. But it's still a lot of little things put together. And I have to come up with, I understand what you're saying, okay, now let's do this or this. So Perception is also, it has memory in it. Okay. The reason you know this is a book is because you've heard it's a book all your life. Now, some perceptions are very accurate, some of them aren't. The perception that comes up with feeling is it's either a pleasant feeling or a painful feeling or neither painful nor pleasant. That's what feeling is. It's not emotion. Okay, emotion happens after you get into your mental proliferation and your opinions and ideas about things. Right after you get into the clinging, then you have your habitual emotional tendencies. In Pali, they call it bhava. And this is where emotion is. Okay, now you're made up of five things. You have a physical body, you have feeling, you have perception, you have thoughts, mental proliferation, and consciousness. When a painful feeling arises, we try to get rid of that painful feeling with our thoughts. This is habitual tendency. And the more we try to think the feeling away, the bigger and more intense that feeling becomes. So the first thing we have to do is stop getting involved in the mental proliferation. How do we do that? 6R. That's right. And what happens after you 6R? Your mind is clear. Your mind is bright. Your mind is pure because it doesn't have any more craving in it. You bring that mind back to wholesome states. Smile. Have a light mind. Take that light mind back to your object of meditation. Stay with your object of meditation for as long as you can. So the 6 R's are real important to understand. This is a tool that helps to purify your mind. And the more you use the 6 R's, the more you purify mind. And that's how you experience Nibbana, by purifying your mind of unwholesome states. You recognize that your mind is distracted away from your object of meditation. You release that distraction. Don't keep your attention on it. Don't get involved in your thoughts about a feeling or try to control the feeling with your thoughts. That only leads to more and more suffering. You relax the tightness caused by that distraction. And this is in agreement with the good qualities of the Dhamma. This is something that a lot of people practicing different forms of meditation don't really do. How many times have you heard about choiceless awareness? Well, I just watch this stuff until it goes away. And then I watch whatever comes up next. People think that's real meditation. It's not. It's mental proliferation a lot. And they're not following right effort. Right effort is recognize there's an unwholesome state that arose. What is that? I am that. Release that. Let it be there by itself. Don't keep your attention on it. People that are practicing straight vipassana, they are told to watch something until it goes away. And as you watch until it goes away, you get caught up in it. And that's suffering. So you need to have that relaxed step. Any practice that does not have the relaxed step in it does not lead to true purity of mind. It does not lead to the Dhamma, the way the Buddha taught it. You have to have the intentional relaxing. I've talked with thousands and thousands of people, and they tell me about their practice. Your mind is on your object of meditation, it gets distracted. They're told to let go of the distraction and immediately come back to your object of meditation. What are you doing when you do that? You're bringing the craving back to your object of meditation, and that takes you off of the path of the Buddha. And those hindrances will keep coming up over and over and over again. I told you in the first talk, I have a friend that's been teaching meditation for 50 years. And from the very start, he has had a fear of talking to groups. And you can still hear it in his voice. There's a hesitation in what he's saying. And that kind of brings me back to what Einstein said. You keep doing the same thing over and over and expect a different result. That's crazy. And it is. What we have to do is get people to realize that there is something subtle that they're not seeing. Now, I did one point of concentration for 20 years. And I had tightness in my head the whole time. And I'd go to the different teachers and I'd say, I've got this tightness in my head. And what do you think they told me to do? Ignore it. It's nothing. I've gone all through the insight knowledges. Supposedly, I become a sotapanna, but I tested it to see whether it was really true or not. When you become a sotapanna, you will not break a precept. So the way I tested it, I intentionally came up with something that I said to someone else that I knew was false. And it didn't. My mind did not waver at all. Now, I'm supposed to be a sotapanna. My mind's not supposed to let me do that. So I became very disillusioned with that practice. All one-pointed concentration still has craving in it. And until you use that relaxed step where you let go of the tension, you're not truly purifying your mind. The force of the concentration will suppress hindrances. But there's no real personality development with that. They can be really peaceful and really calm and be in blissful states of meditation. But the end result is not Nibbana. When they lose their concentration, get into their daily life, they have hindrances just like they always had them. I've heard people get in huge, angry arguments about whether this is the right way or that's the right way. And you can feel the anger coming off of them. Now, is that purifying your mind? Well, this person is very advanced. They might be advanced in one-pointed concentration, but they don't understand how mind works. How is the question? How does this work? Not why. Why, we can leave that for the therapist and the psychoanalyst and the psychiatrist. They can play with that all they want. We want to know, how does this stuff arise? In order to see, you have a good working eye. Color and form. Eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three is called eye contact. With eye contact as condition, eye feeling arises. With eye feeling as condition, perception arises. Perception is a part of the mind that says, when this feeling comes up, it's painful. When this feeling comes up, it's pleasant. When this feeling comes up, it's neither painful nor pleasant. That's all perception does, is just name things. With that as condition, I craving arises. I like it if it's pleasant. I don't like it if it's painful. I don't care. I'm indifferent if it's neutral. Now, what's the definition of mindfulness? Remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. How does it move? What happens first? What happens after that? What happens after that? I just told you. This is how eye consciousness arises. And then the feeling, and then the perception, and then the craving, and then the mental proliferation sets in. And what is mental proliferation? Thinking about, analyzing. That's what psychologists do mostly, is analyze. And that's part of the Western disease. It's part of the problems that we have today, because we keep on asking, well, why did this happen? Well, when you were 6 months old, your mother shut a drawer and hurt your finger. And now you cry very easily. That doesn't heal that. What heals it is seeing it as a hindrance arises, some dissatisfaction in one way or another. What do you do with that? You 6R. You allow that hindrance to be there by itself. You 6R. Smile, come back to your object of meditation, stay with your object of meditation. But it goes back to that. Okay, do it again. Every time you use the 6Rs, you are improving your mindfulness. It gets sharper. You start seeing more clearly how the process works. Sloth and torpor arises. or restlessness arises. What are you supposed to do when they arise? 6R. When you start to 6R, let's say, sloth and torpor, then your mindfulness is a little bit sharper. You start looking at how did this sloth and torpor arise? Not why, we don't care about why. How did it arise? Well, I'm already sleepy and I'm supposed to relax. No, you're supposed to take more interest in how this process works. Sloth and torpor generally arises because you lose your interest in staying with your object of meditation. A little bit. You lose your mindfulness. A little bit. That's why it's a hindrance. Pulls you away from your object of meditation. So when you relax, what you're relaxing is a tightness caused by that mind's movement. And when you become do that enough with the hindrance, your mindfulness will eventually say, you know, right before my mind got really pulled away, there was something else that was there. Something else happened first. So the next time sloth and torpor comes up, and it's this with any of the hindrances, I'm just using sloth and torpor as the example. When that other little movement happened right before your mind got taken away, then you 6R as soon as you see that. And you'll do that for a little while, and you'll see, well, right before that arose, there was something else that happened. Then you 6R the next time you see that arise. What's the result of doing this? You start to stay on your object of meditation for longer, and the distraction, when it comes, doesn't last for as long. The restlessness or mental proliferation is another example of how to do this. Start looking at how does this process work? That's why I'm saying your hindrances are your teacher. They're showing you right up front. This is what's happening. Now you have to pay attention. What happened first? What happened after that? What happened after that? Now, both sloth and torpor, you better become pretty friendly with these two hindrances, because they're going to last until you become an arahat. So become friends with them. Don't fight them. Yeah, but my mind's going all over the place. I'm thinking this and that. Don't get caught up in the story. Don't get caught up in the content of the thoughts. Because that's nonsense. That's real nonsense. As you become more familiar with how it arises, you start catching it a little more quickly and a little more quickly. That's how you progress in your meditation. Yeah. That's fine. You can ask. Right after feeling and perception. And perception. They feeling and perception are concomitant. If you don't know what that means, they're joined together. They always arise this way. The feeling arises, then that's painful. Right after that, craving arises. Okay? And that's where you want to be. As soon as that feeling and perception are there, 6R. Okay? Then there is no clinging. There is no mental proliferation. And if there's no mental proliferation, there's no habitual tendencies. If there's no habitual tendencies, there's no birth of action. If there's no birth, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. In other words, you're purifying your mind. But if you can see contact before the feeling arises and you 6R right then feeling won't arise. And if feeling doesn't arise, that big craving doesn't arise. If craving doesn't arise, clinging doesn't arise, and it goes all the way through that. This is dependent origination. And this is called the cessation of this mass of suffering. As you start to go deeper into your meditation, you can see. You won't necessarily see the six sense doors, because there's six of them. But you will see name and form. You can see that arise. And right before that, there is consciousness. And when you are able to see that, which happens at neither perception nor non-perception. You'll see little movements of mind's attention, and you 6R right then, and it goes away. That was one of the links of dependent origination. Now you're purifying your mind even more. This is how it works. Yes?
When you're talking about mindfulness in meditation, when you bring that outside of the practice in your daily life.
There's no such a thing as outside of the practice.
You don't have to be sitting.
No.
No. It's a constant process.
It is. Why do I try to get you to smile all the time? So that your mindfulness is improving. So you can see how these things start to come up and you can catch them and you don't have these emotional outbursts. Okay, you start developing more equanimity. I wrote a book called Meditation is Life. Life is meditation. You can't take one from the other. And that's another problem with one-pointed concentration, because the force of the concentration suppresses the hindrances where your attachments are. When you lose that concentration, the hindrances come up and you don't know what to do with them, and they're stronger. And that's why there's no real personality development with one-pointed concentration. And the only difference between one-pointed concentration and what I'm showing you right now is the relaxed step, is being able to recognize that tightness in your head and relax. That changes the entire meditation and puts you on the path of the Buddha's teaching. Go.
Can you say one more time, the state is perception and non-perception?
Yeah. Neither perception nor non-perception.
That's the state that allows you to see that?
Yeah, but you won't recognize it as such. It's just a little tiny movement. But as you start to go from, well, let's say, letting go of craving, the feeling when it comes up is about half as big. When you see the feeling and you see the contact, that's about half as big as a feeling. It gets more and more subtle as you start letting these things go. Now, one of the things that's real interesting when you start truly understanding how dependent origination works, you can start seeing it in all of life. You'll see it come up in other people. You'll see how their anger starts to build, or how their greed starts to build, or whatever it happens to be. But you can see it in terms of dependent origination. Why get caught up in that? Right? You have more and more balance in your mind. You have stronger and stronger equanimity. Now, some of you have been talking about disenchantment. What is disenchantment? It's a finer kind of equanimity. It's a much more subtle kind of equanimity. Yeah. I don't know that I can. How can I elaborate on that more? It's, you have more balance with everything. All material things. You know, before you started meditating, there was always the I want, and go out and get it, whatever that happens to be, whether it's food or candy or cigarettes or whatever it happens to be. But as you become disenchanted with these things, you start letting them go and you keep your balance of mind. Okay? Yeah?
As I become more disenchanted, I notice that I don't have as many friends.
You'll start to pick up many more Dhamma friends.
Yeah, I think I just have that in between friends.
Yeah. It happens to the best of us. And we were talking with Grant about at our center, no, it wasn't Grant, it was with Elaine. We were talking about how much fun it is to be with people that really understand. And we get in discussions about Pali words. What he gives this definition, he gives that definition. What are we going to do? Which one is more accurate? And we have really fun conversations. And people that are sloppy, okay, I'll give you an example of something that happened to me when I was a layman still in San Francisco. I went to a party. There was about 30 people there. And I just stopped being in taking care of Usilananda. Okay, I was in a monastery for 2 years taking care of this great monk. He was a fantastic monk. And I'm sitting at this party and they pull out some beer and they're pulling out a little bit of pot. And I'm not interested in that kind of stuff at all. So I thought, well, okay, let's see what happens. I started radiating loving kindness. And people started getting up and going into another room. And before long, I was sitting there alone. Their minds were sloppy. and there were their conversation was not worth saying any words. It just was nonsense stuff. And as I'm sitting there, I guess I might as well leave. There's nobody to talk to here. But the people that left and went in the other room, some of them came back. And they were the ones that weren't drinking or smoking pot or whatever it was they were doing. And they were interested in spiritual things. So we had a great conversation. There was two or three people that came in, and we really had fun that night. But everybody else, they felt very threatened by being around somebody that was alert, not, quote, taking the edge off with a beer or with some pot. We don't have to take the edge off. We don't have edges like that. So you're going to start drawing more and more people that are truly interested in Dhamma. And you'll get into some great conversations. When I was in Asia as a monk, I'd go up to a monk and we'd sit down and we would have absolutely fantastic conversations that were real fun and they're very educational and we really understood what each of us was talking about. And I never even learned their name. But they were Dhamma brothers. That sort of thing happens. The people that are sloppy, they'll start to fade away. The people that are truly interested in how all this stuff works, what is the Buddha's teaching really, you're going to start having more of those kind of friends. And once you have a friend like that, if you don't see them in 5 years, you get together with them, it's like no time left. No, there's no time in between. We get together, we have fun, we talk, we always get around to Dhamma and how things work. So be patient. Yeah. You will when your mindfulness is sharp enough. You have consciousness. What do you? I don't understand what you're asking. Okay. No, you become more alive. You appreciate things much more. A classic example is this one lady that was an anagami. I watched her go out. I was on Bali at the time in this beautiful meditation center, just fantastic. And there's this lake out there, and there's a hill up above, and the clouds are coming in, and they're starting to come down, and she's watching that. And she completely enjoyed it without distracting thoughts. And I asked her if she had any distracting thoughts. She said, no. I'm enjoying watching the beauty of nature as it's unfolding. It doesn't mean that you become a zombie. But you don't have another example. I give you some mango. Do you like mango? I'll give you a really, really good mango. What happens in your mind when you start eating it? Do you notice the taste and how it tastes on the surface? And then you start thinking about something else. And then you start thinking about something else. That mental proliferation takes you away from truly enjoying a great mango. Why? Is it pulling my attention away from what I'm doing in the present? It's when you start thinking about other things, you don't even know you're eating mango anymore because you're thinking about something else. Now that's where the distraction is. That's where the hindrance is. Come back to enjoying the mango, you will enjoy it completely. That doesn't mean you're attached to it. Yeah.
It just occurred to me, so when one is eating food and they think about something else, then the craving energy can slip in.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's why.
Yeah. Do it again louder.
When you're eating, if your mind starts to get away from the food and you start thinking of other things, craving energy slips in and takes over.
Yeah.
So you just start stuffing your mouth.
That's one of the big trials. You have to be disenchanted with popcorn.
It's funny because it's almost like ego. Learned how to apply dependent origination. I was walking past some donuts at the Bonds Market, and that's when it all clicked with the eye contact and how it grows up. And I walked past.
Did you walk past and then stop and go back and get some? I'm only teasing.
Yeah, no, because sometimes I do go back. But I'm sick, sorry, and it's getting better.
So the advertising industry must be experts in this process, don't you
think? Absolutely. Experts at getting you to want something. I love chocolate, but I was eating so much candy and that sort of thing, I started thinking, you know, I better stop doing this because I'm going to get some diabetes if I'm not careful. So I made up my mind, I'm not going to do any more candy for a period of time. Even desserts, I don't want desserts. I'll eat fruit for desserts. And when I made up my mind that that's what was going to happen, I could walk down a candy aisle and not be distracted by the wrappers on the candy. It was like walking down an aisle of soap. It was no big deal. So when you see that you have a certain kind of attachment that you don't want it anymore, make a determination, I'm going to let it go. And stay to that. Don't let that craving come in and that little devil on your shoulder that says, yeah, but it tastes good. This is, you ought to get some of this. Okay, where was I? Oh. Ah, dependent on the ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. With the meeting of the three is ear contact. With ear contact as condition, there is ear feeling. When one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present sounds cognizable through the ear. Okay. Dependent on the nose and odors, nose consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is nose contact. With nose contact as condition, there is nose feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. That's where all your stories and opinions and ideas cause problems. Because if somebody doesn't agree with your concepts, opinions, and ideas, now you get into mental jousting. And that can even turn into wars because of not understanding how this process works. What one mentally proliferates as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present. Odors cognizable through the nose. Dependent on the tongue and flavors, tongue consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is tongue contact. With tongue contact as condition, there is tongue feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present. Taste cognizable through the tongue. Dependent on the body and tangibles, body consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is body contact. With body contact as condition, there is body feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, with respect to the past, future, and present, tangibles cognizable through the body. Dependent on mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is mind contact. With mind contact as condition, there is mind feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present mind objects cognizable through mind. When there is the I of form and I consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of eye contact. When there is the manifestation of eye contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of eye feeling. When there's the manifestation of eye feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the ear, a sound, and ear consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of ear contact. When there's the manifestation of ear contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of ear feeling. When there's the manifestation of ear feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the nose and odor and nose consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of nose contact. When there is the manifestation of nose contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of nose feeling. When there is the manifestation of nose feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the tongue of flavor and tongue consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of tongue contact. When there's the manifestation of tongue contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of tongue feeling. When there's the manifestation of tongue feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the body, a tangible and body consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of body contact. When there's the manifestation of body contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of body feeling. When there's the manifestation of body feeling, excuse me, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there is the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is mind, a mind object, and mind consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of mind contact. When there is the manifestation of mind contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of mind feeling. When there is the manifestation of mind feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there's no I, no form, and no I consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of I contact. When there is no manifestation of I contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of mind feeling. When there's no manifestation of mind feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of mind feeling, or thinking, excuse me. When there is no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by notions and perceptions born of mental proliferation. When there's no ear, no sound, no ear consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of ear contact. When there's no manifestation of ear contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of ear feeling. When there's no manifestation of ear feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there's no nose, no odors, and no nose consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of nose contact. When there's no manifestation of nose contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of nose feeling. When there's no manifestation of nose feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is no tongue and no flavor and no tongue consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of tongue contact. When there's no manifestation of tongue contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of tongue feeling. When there's no manifestation of tongue feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there's no body, no tangible and no body consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of body contact. When there is no manifestation of body contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of feeling. Excuse me just a moment. We'll try that. Okay, I was with body. I did contact.
Is there a generalization that would cover each one of these cases?
Is there what?
Is there a conceptual generalization which would allow us to get the truth of it without having to go through the 460,000 variants of it
when
you state it
concretely? Patience. When there's no manifestation of body feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there's no mind, no mind objects, and no mind consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of mind contact. When there's no manifestation of mind contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of mind feeling. When there's no manifestation of mind feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. Friend, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, monks, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust. of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to delusion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states seat without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of this summary to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish to go to the Blessed One and ask him the meaning of this, as the Blessed One explains it to you, you should remember it. Then the monks, having delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, "Then, Venerable Sir, we went to the Venerable Mahakachana and asked him about the meaning. The Venerable Mahakachana expounded the meaning to us with these terms, statements, and phrases." Mahakachana is wise, monks. Mahakachana has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. Such is the meaning of this, and so you should remember it. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted and hung from hunger and weakness came upon a honey ball, wherever he would taste, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, Venerable One, any able-bodied monk, wherever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Venerable Sir, what is the name of the discourse on the Dhamma? As to that, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the honey ball discourse." That's what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Now, this particular sutta is what Venerable Jnanananda used, and he called this book Concept and Reality. And he explains this very well. We do have some copies. I don't know how many.
Not many. Six, seven.
You got to be quick if you want one. This sutta is very deep and it is very profound. Your mental proliferation and interrupting the Dhamma in that way is not respectful. I accept completely. Yes, and this is not where you're going to hear the most repetition. You're going to hear another sutta that has a lot more repetition in it. And it is the most powerful sutta in all of the Majjhima Nikaya. But you're going to hear over and over again all six of the sense doors. So prepare yourself for that. Don't cross your arms. have kind of a funny story about this. I was in Sri Lanka and I went to visit this monk that wrote Concept and Reality, and he told me the story about it. He was 21 or 22 years old and he was writing his PhD. And that's what this book is his thesis. And he got almost done with it when his teacher died. And he wasn't able to turn it in because his teacher wasn't there to turn it in for him. And when he finally got it, got another teacher, and he okayed all the stuff, and he started to turn it in, there was two other monks that had written on the same subject. And they said, we don't need this. Write another thesis. So he did. He got his PhD. But he held on to the manuscript for 15 years. And he happened to go visit Jnanaponika, who was a German monk, very, very good scholar. And he showed it to Jnanaponika. And Jnanaponika said, we have to get this printed up. This is great stuff. And Jnanaponika went to Kandy, set up the Buddhist Publication Society because of this book. And then he started printing up a lot more. It's still alive and well today. But when I was in Sri Lanka, I went to visit this monk. He's 6 or 8 years older than I am, but he's very, very sickly. He only has about a quarter of one of his lungs that works. So I paid my respect to him and I sat down and I said, Bhante, may I have permission to print up 5,000 copies of this book? And he said, no. And I asked him why, and he said, people are selling this book and it's supposed to be for free distribution. And he said, you come here asking for 5,000 copies. There's this place over in America called Dhammasukha Meditation Center, and they ask for 250 copies. And I kind of chuckled and I said, that was me. But the next time I went to Sri Lanka, he gave me permission to print up as many copies as I wanted. But he did stipulate that it had to be printed in Sri Lanka, which is very difficult. If you send it by boat, it might take 6 to 8 months to get it. So I only copied up, I made about 1,000 copies and I was going to ship them, and the cost of shipping was so, it was like over $1,000. That's $1 a book just to ship it. So I had friends that were coming to America and they put them in their suitcases, and we got, I think, all of the copies out now. Jnanananda is truly a remarkable scholar. And he has written a bunch of other books. He was asked to start giving discourses on Nibbana. And he gave 31 discourses on Nibbana. And when you read along, he says, you know, in the commentary, they have this Pali word, and they say that it means this, but they made a mistake. And actually, this word means that. And he makes a lot of sense of with his translation. And he calls his English like baby English, but he gives great Dhamma talks. Takes a little bit to get used to his accent, but it's not difficult. But he does read a lot of Pali words, but then he explains what it is, so it's all understandable. So, do you have any questions? Yeah.
Are these 31 discourses on your website? Yeah.
Yes. You can go and listen to them. He gave the discourses in Sri Lankan, and then he translated, and then he reads the translation. So he's doing all of that. He's got some real interesting ideas. The word Sankara in Pali, it's always translated as formations. And it means the formation of body, speech, and mind. He calls it preparations. And as I started thinking about that very deeply, I really like that. Because that's what they are. They're preparations of body, speech, and mind that work in through dependent origination, and that's how come we have this understanding.
So if I understood what you read, what it was covering each of the possible sensory outflows
right.
down the chain of dependent origination.
Right.
But the point that wasn't made, which I'd love you to clarify, is that that is a possible route, but there could be a cessation of that at a higher level if the person was evolved enough, presumably.
As you go deeper, yes. Yes. But you have to understand, if there is no ignorance, formations will not arise. If formations don't arise, consciousness doesn't arise. If consciousness doesn't arise, name and mind and body, not mind and body, name and form, name and form don't arise. If name and form don't arise, the six sense doors don't arise. If the six sense doors don't arise, contact doesn't arise. If contact doesn't arise, feeling doesn't arise. If feeling doesn't arise, craving doesn't arise. If craving doesn't arise, clinging doesn't arise. If clinging doesn't arise, habitual tendency doesn't arise. If habitual tendency doesn't arise, birth of action doesn't arise. If birth doesn't arise, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair won't arise. That's the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This just gives you a little bit of the dependent origination. But tomorrow you're going to get it all. Okay. You need any other stories? Why don't we share some merit then? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.